Are you ready, guys?
Oh, yes, excuse me. We're having our own. We're asking and answering our own questions.
This question is, how have you in all situations in everyday life stopped fighting someone or something as described in the 10 steps?
Someone or something. Well, I'll just describe my experience of the 10th step. I can't think of a sort of specific answer. Well, it's self-will is the answer. I'm in general. But for me, the 10th step is it's just a process of constantly taking inventory and every resentment that I get, trying to stop myself and not act on it, and realize that the problem is me, and to write it down and acknowledge that the problem with the feeling is in that final column, as you saw in the diagram that was on the board. And so I find that the degree that I accept what's going on and stop fighting events around me, if you like, is the degree that I don't have resentment when it doesn't go with me. I can't think of a specific example I want to put on the spot. It's the best I can do.
There's a... my name is Tom Needham. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
There's a part in our book that talks about a man, I think it was either Jim or Fred, I can't recall, but he talks about when the temptation of alcohol comes to him, a great revulsion comes up inside of him. And I'm human, and I suffer from this thing called the human condition. And the implication in the 10th step is that when I'm resentful, when I'm selfish, when I'm afraid, I turn to God and ask Him to have that removed. Sometimes I'm not awake to that, even the fight, and especially when we're out in the world, in a job. For example, I think I was talking with Ronnie about that earlier. And it's a situation where if I don't take some action regarding that, that same type of revulsion that I had with alcohol couldn't happen just because something like that is pulling on me. I'm fighting something. Okay, if I'm fighting something, it's pulling on me, and I'm awake to that, thank God. My experience has been when I'm not fighting it, when I'm not fighting it, I'm in worse trouble because I'm not awake to it. But if I'm just awake, it says we are not fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. Anyone or anything, even alcohol. So that's a huge promise, and I'm not supposed to be fighting anything. My wife has got her path. Okay. The people on the job, they have their path. Okay. The only thing that separates me and the rest of the world out there is that second half of that first step, the unmanageability. But if I stay in that long enough, it's going to take me back to something that's going to kill me.
And there's a question about in page 188. It's basically described the first step call in one of the story, alcoholic number 3. And it says, there's a question where it says, you can quit for 24 hours, can you? And the answer is, yes, anybody can do that. And this question sounds, it says in Danish, I'll try to translate it, I couldn't do that, and I can't get those two things together, you know, the question and the powerlessness and that 24-hour thing. How can it be that they talk about this in the group and the person says, I can't stay sober for 24 hours because I'm powerless. But here in page 188, they say, hey, Anybody can do it. Or at least the alcoholic number three says. So.
Right, but alcoholic number three?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's in, is that the Danish?
No, it's Danish.
That's Danish. Okay, 188. We're in, I thought you were in the first 164. I says, wait a minute, we're into the stories.
It's in one of the stories, yes.
Okay. If what you're saying is true, that a person can't stay sober for a period of 24 hours, well, my book tells me that man needs help if he's willing to go away. In the United States, we have what they call detoxification centers. Mm-hmm. And a man goes into a hospital. And it's important because depending upon how sick this man or woman is, they need that medical attention. They don't have to. I've experienced delirium tremors. So there's people in this day and age don't have to do that. So if the man is willing, and he has to clear his mind a bit anyway, to be open to what we have to offer in this program of recovery. If that answers the question.
Yeah, I think the same. I don't know what to do about stopping in the first place. I mean, mine, in a sense, AA stepped in when I had to. It was the staying stops that AA helped me with. So, in a sense, good.
I have a friend in AA who is taking relapse after relapse after relapse. What can I do or say to help her, if anything? Do you have any suggestions?
Well, I can identify with the friend, because I was a chronic relapse.
Oops.
And the person that asked that question or wrote that question out is here tonight. And the best that you can do is just to demonstrate the principles that God, with God's power through you, and be there. Because you never know. I don't know. Some people, they come in, and for me, my experience is that alcohol was the great persuader. There's a guy by the name of Jim W. I never get an opportunity to meet the man, but he passed away not too long ago. And he shares it something like this. If you live, we'll get you. If you live, we'll get you. But it doesn't have to be. I have to be there. I have to be, like Peter said earlier today, I have to be that copy of the big book for that person. If that person's not willing to sit down and get some help. Okay.
Yeah, I'll just say the same. I'm powerless over that person. And all I can be is an example, which is actually true over the people who want the program as well. You know, all we can do is just say, here's my experience. And it's really down to the individual whether or not they want to do it. And if they don't, I don't know how to make somebody want it. I can't answer that question.
Yeah. You sort of answered the next question I pulled out. Is what if your prospect will not take your suggestions? I think you just covered that one or two.
Yeah.
So.
Continue doing what's working for you.
Yeah. Do you consider hot flash to be essential for getting it, or do you believe in momentary enlightenment, sort of small chunks at a time, can do with the trick too? Did you get that one?
Yes. Oh. I think I got it. I think you were talking about the spiritual experience. And but again, I have to agree with Peter, and that's, you know, like my experience as well. When God shows up, God shows up. And I'll know that. When I was first introduced to this program of recovery, a little over 9 years ago, after bouncing around for a couple of decades, I knew something was happening to me. I couldn't describe it. It was like the first, it was 4 days separated from alcohol, and someone gave me something to do with the doctor's opinion. They asked me to highlight everything that I could identify with, everything that I think I should know, and everything that I thought was important. And they gave me that lay aside prayer just before that. And I suffered from the obsession of alcohol daily. I couldn't, as Dave mentioned, stay stopped. I had no control, no choice. I was drinking, period. As I mentioned, I think on, Friday night, they talk about meeting makers make it. And I was going to four or five meetings a week, and I was drinking after every one of them. So much for meeting makers make it. And, but on that night, and it was only a couple hours before, I was seriously considering taking myself off the planet, because I was that guy in the doctor's opinion when they talk about there are some that make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. And I was at that place. So I was given that assignment, and I did what this man told me to do in this assignment, and he was about 600 miles away because I was down in Richmond, Virginia. And I did what he asked me to do, and things started to bounce off of those pages. It was the first time that I really started to believe this trust in God, but I didn't see it until a few days later on. And that's the way it usually is with us, as we were sharing today. You always see things in hindsight, after the fact. I was too foggy to see it then, But I remember, after doing that assignment, getting on my knees again and then going into that hotel room bed and laying down. And I remember vividly, and I don't know where this came from a guy that could not stop drinking, that it was going to be okay after a battle of 20 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. So you know when it happens. So.
I've had nothing remotely like a hot flash. I'm the sort of person that if I did, I'd just go straight down to the psychiatrist and assume I was going mad. I would not believe it if it happened. So thank goodness God has not sent one to me. I don't doubt that it has happened to others, but it's just not the sort of thing that's going to convince me. For me, a spiritual awakening is what the big book says, and I've had that result in abundance, a sane, happy, useful life, beyond my wildest dreams. The means by which I've got it, if you sort of look at the progress, if I compare what I was like 15 years ago, it's a huge transformation. But at the time, I'm not aware of any great emotional surges. It all seems very straightforward. The means by which, remember, we have to talk in sort of our views of God and the higher power, but God created the world, he created everything. Why use the extraordinary to demonstrate it when the world we're used to is created by God as well? So his work through people in a very normal, straightforward way. The miracle, if you like, that I have every single day is that I'm sober. And that is the extent of my sort of emotional surge. I'm not the sort of person who reacts in that way, and I'm not looking for that. And to be honest, I'd be suspicious if I experienced it. So I'm sure that's why I haven't been given it. But I don't doubt anything that any others say at all. Different people, we get what we need in order to, God gives us what we need in order to make that the effort that we have to make in order to change. And I think he understands that everybody's different and unique.
What is your opinion about the difference between spiritual experience and what's called the other one?
Spiritual awakening.
Yes.
it's, I don't know, I classify it one and the same. You know, my awakening, just like Dave mentioned, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, it's not extraordinary. My awakening is that I'm awake today to this moment. That's an experience within itself. I think that's all I have to say on that. You know, it's...
Well, I think in this context, again, I wasn't aware of a distinction. I just thought there were different phrases used to describe the same thing. But, you know, the spiritual awakening that alcoholics experience in AA is just one example of, you know, many, many different sorts of spiritual experiences that all sorts of people, not just alcoholics, have had over centuries. But I assume that whoever's written that is pulling the phrases out of the big book, and I'm not conscious. I've never really registered in my mind any difference. Perhaps I'm wrong.
Well, as I understand it, the manuscript, the original manuscript, and I think I may have it in my book, when it talked, when it gave the form of the way the 12th step was going to be written originally, was that we had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps. And then somehow or another they changed it to spiritual awakening. I guess maybe an experience was, you know, that they figured that it was an experience, you know, they were focusing on it as opposed to what we see, an awakening. An awakening sounds to me like it says in the spiritual experience in the appendix in the back of the book that it talks about, it goes over. So I agree as well. I think it's one and the same thing. It was just, the first 100 drunks couldn't agree on upon which one they were going to do, and it appears that the awakening went outruled the experience.
What is your experience? What in your experience,
I can't read my own writing.
I think I'll take another question, just a moment. Is there, in your opinion, anything like coincidence?
Well, yes, coincidence is what we think it is when two events occur that are in an, you know, that correspond in an unexpected way. If the questioner is saying, is it guided by God? Well, you know, I believe everything is guided by God, whether it's coincidental or not. What I don't do is start looking for signs and symbols and everything that goes on around me. As I say, I believe that God created the ordinary as well as the extraordinary and doesn't need coincidental happenings and extraordinary happenings to demonstrate that he is good and the world is good. So coincidences can happen, and God is behind everything, whether it's coincidental or not. That's my view, but it's just a personal outlook.
I guess coincidence has a definition, as Dave shared. But for me, I think I'm more to the, I must stay awake. As Peter shared earlier, you know, like I must be awake to the present moment. And if I'm awake to the present moment, the way I perceive things through the grace of God, okay, my perception of that. There's a guy by the name of Chuck C, and he has a tape out and a book called The New Pair of Glasses. And that's been my experience. A total transformation took place. I don't look at things, you know, the way I used to look at things. Okay? And I take things, it says in our book, that the uncommon becomes common. The uncommon becomes, I don't underestimate the power of God.
Can I just come back in that? I mean, I imagine what the question is saying here is, can we start reading signs and symbols into things? I don't know if that's the gist behind the question. Well, the answer is possibly yes. I mean, any idea, if it puts an idea in your mind, and this is the way I approach it, then it might come from God, but it's just as likely to come from me, and I'm misreading it. When I do my daily meditation, I do a quiet time, but like it describes in the big book, and I write down the thoughts that occur. Now, I'll tell you what most of those thoughts are. They're things that are extraordinary for me as an alcoholic, but it is things like pay the electricity bill, answer that telephone call, respond to that message. It's just the standard things in the day. Now, if I got a thought which said emigrate to Papua New Guinea, I would consider it, okay? But I would. That's one of those things where I think I would apply common sense as well. I mean, I can't be certain that that thought comes from God. And I think what I would do, I would look at it in the cold light of day afterwards. Having said that, I wouldn't just automatically discount it, because when I go to my sponsor, he might just tell me that there are a lot of openings for people with my skill set in Papua New Guinea. I don't know. But I think, you know...
You want to get rid of you.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's what, yeah. But for me, common sense, so what happens is that common sense and reason have a greater place in my life now than they did before. I'm better at using them than I was before. I'm prepared to consider other things, but if it seemed nonsensical and ridiculous, I wouldn't do it, no matter how much I felt it was true. I would take advice.
How do you live life on God's terms and not on life's terms?
You know, David shared during his talk about this is a design for living that really works even in the rough going. I'm experiencing something that's happening in our family and it's causing a lot of pain. And I have to go back to my sponsorship on a man by the name of Don P. And he talks about sobriety isn't pain-free. It's not pain-free. Like Dave and the experiences, you know, the things that I've seen God do for me, what I could never do for myself. You know, I've got to be nuts not to continue and do what's been happening on this path and have new experiences. So I guess the question is, you know, on life's terms, I'm not immune, okay? You know, there's a guy by the name of Bob O, he says it so eloquently, the way I heard it. He'll say, well, if you really want to be happy, joyous, and free all the time, maybe you should check yourself into some type of sanitarium or rehab and shoot yourself up with Thorazine and do the shuffle for the rest of your life.
Well, I would say that, in all honesty, I've not had a bad day in recovery. I haven't, as I explained, I haven't been immune to things happening to me. There are plenty of things that I would like to complain about in my life. But my experience is that when I look at what it is I'm feeling, it's either a resentment or fear, and I've been shown how to deal with that. And sometimes I do have to work a lot harder than other times to deal with that. But it really is down to the amount of work that I put into the program. And I can only share my experience. That really is how it has been for me.
What is your experience about one's upbringing being the cause of one's alcoholism?
I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I've heard it said, you know, from people that I respect in this fellowship that why not just take that inner child, throw it out in the street, and let it get run over by a truck? Okay. I'm not saying that we have, we don't, when we don't, we have to go back. We have to go back. Our book tells us to go back. But I'm a grown adult today. Okay. And I have to take responsibility for my life. And I have to take responsibility for my participation in this program of recovery. For too many years, I acted like that inner child in and around the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, expecting things happening for me. Where's mine? It's a program of action, and it's action against my will, usually. But then I have to go back to my friend Mark when he talks about, you know, we drank alcohol because of the effect produced by alcohol. It got us to a place of ease and comfort. And I took action. I took a glass and I put it to my lips and I took action to do that. Okay. And my friend Joel say that that's what I do today. I take actions against my will. Why do I do it? Because I like the effect produced by it today in this program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous.
I suppose what I'd say is I simply don't know. I mean, I have all sorts of opinions, but they're irrelevant as regard to my recovery goes. I had to learn one thing as I was an alcoholic and then how to recover from it. I learned nothing about what the cause was. You know, if you ask me, I suppose, like most things, it's going to be a combination of nature and nurture. But frankly, it's irrelevant and I'm not interested. One thing that I really do agree with is that we are not the victims of events that have happened to us in the past. Once we have the program, we are in a position to take responsibility for our own lives and lead happy, sane, useful lives, regardless of what has happened to us in the past.
How can I tell an alcoholic who only do half the program, that is meeting no more, that I think they should do it all, steps with sponsor, without making them mad and without doing more damage than help?
I'll come into. I mean, we sort of answered this before. It's like all these things. I am powerless over the alcoholic. All I can do is go to meetings and share my experience. And I tend to spend my time where it is most useful. And whilst, if I had unlimited time, I'd be talking to every drunkard for unlimited periods. But frankly, I tend to spend most time with those who want to hear what I have to say. And that's what working with others tells me. You know, I understand where the question is coming from. When people we love or friends in AA suffer, it's terrible to see sometimes, especially when you know that it's very, very simple. You know, it's simple but not easy. But I have to tell you, it's a lot easier than not doing it when you're in the program. But we are powerless, and I just have to. I look at that chapter, working with others, and we haven't been through that in detail yet. I mean, you'll get the answers tomorrow, but it's in there. Yeah.
Like David said, and I have to agree, I have to follow the directions in the book, and it is working with others. Because if a man isn't willing, when I work with somebody, I have to see action. I'll go with you if you're taking the action. But if you're not taking the action, I can't go with you. Got another friend up in Colorado. He talks about, I care, but I can't care if you don't care.
I got a great spiritual awakening 2.5 years ago through the steps that changed my life completely. but there is something missing. What can I do to get closer to God and that ease and comfort you have talked so much about?
It's very difficult. I mean, you need to talk to somebody. Approach somebody who is talking about these things. Ask the question, and you can go through it. But it comes down to the steps. It's trust God, clean house, help others. And somewhere along the line, some element of those three things is not being done, in my experience. And it's not that I can't help. But I've never met anyone yet who has not had that wonderful experience continue. If they continue to have that emphasis in those three areas in their lives. Specifically, I need to know what the person's doing and isn't doing. Either you're doing something you shouldn't or you're not doing something you should.
I can identify with the person that asked the question, I think. When you're talking about having a spiritual experience and it being profound, but I was at a place where I was attached to that experience, that initial profound experience. It was life-changing. Changed my life. It was drastic. But to be attached to that experience, I'll never have that experience again. And it's no different than right now. We're all here at this moment. We'll never experience this moment all here, just the way it is right now, ever again. It's a matter of moving on and being awake. Okay? And more, you see, even then, when I was having the identification, as you asked that question, where's my friend Don? He says it's like the alcoholic war cry. Where's mine? Where's mine? I need to have another profound spiritual experience. God gave me power. He wants me to use that power the way I see it and demonstrate it in the principles in my home and with another drunk across at the kitchen table. Because we're in a life-saving business now. It's not about where's mine anymore. It's about my constant thought of others. Where can I help?
What's your opinion of long-distance sponsorship, or in other words, online sponsorship?
I'm not qualified. Long-distance sponsorship. Well, I mean, the answer is whatever works, as long as it gets you through the steps. It depends. I mean, certainly, the way that it depends on the different varieties of sponsors, the different ways individuals take it through. The way that I was taken through the steps, it would be very difficult in that initial phase of going through the first 9 steps if you didn't see your sponsor regularly. I was shown how to do my 4th step. I had to go and see him to take my 5th step. So if he'd been in California or something, it would have been very difficult to do that. At the moment, I know people who are in my position who have sponsors who are a long way away, and that is once you're on 10, 11, and 12 in experience, it is possible, though not ideal, is what I would say. But perfectly reasonable, but very difficult in the early stages. But I wouldn't put that down as a hard and fast rule, because it's a question of the practicalities, and maybe there are ways that I haven't thought of that would allow that to happen, even in the very early days. And frankly, anything is better than nothing at all.
I agree. Frankly, anything is better nothing than nothing at all. But I personally have no experience, okay, with telephone work. I've always gravitated to having someone come over, inviting him into my home. And just the way I was invited into someone else's home. And I'm not saying that's... In fact, even today, the man that carried the message to me lives in New York. on Staten Island. And the message was carried to him by someone that was out on the West Coast in California over the phone. Okay? He was a pioneer on Staten Island, this man. He blazed the trail. Okay? He was doing 5-6 people a night, 5-6 times a week. He was carrying a message. So, but as far as the initial time to do it, as if you have to do it over the phone, he had to do it over the phone. He didn't know anyone around that was actually doing the deal. Going through the steps the second time or the third time, I don't see any problems with that because I have disciplines in place in 10, 11, and 12. I guess that's what I can say about that.
Can I just say that one thing that I would really say, just from my experience, I've sponsored somebody in Ireland, I mean, actually going through the steps. I have sponsees now who are not in England at that sort of latter stage, and that seems to work fine. And it was possible, and we did it because there was nobody where he was who had the program as this is in the big book at all. And it was not ideal. We did it. We travelled to see each other, and we got as much as we could in these sort of long weekends together. So it is possible. And I would say it's always better to be guided by somebody who's got experience with the programme than anybody who's available on a daily basis and doesn't have the experience. It's the experience that's the most important thing. That's what I would say.
Do you have experience from getting sponsees that you definitely don't want, but you can't say no?
I've experienced that people came to me and I looked and I wasn't too sure if they were willing to go to any lengths. I wouldn't say I didn't like them. I would say that that was my perception of that particular situation at hand. But I can't say no. I can't say no. Responsible.
No.
How do you understand the word vital in vital spiritual experience? What do you think Bill meant when he wrote vital?
Where is the reference? Say this again. I'm not sure.
Vital spiritual.
Vital. V-I-T-A-L.
Vital. Oh, there's necessary. It's what is needed in order to recover. Is that? Am I missing the trick there?
No, I think
right.
So. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Because I think it first came out with like what Dr. Jung said. You know, to Roland Hazard. You know, that he's seen vital experience, spiritual experiences occur. They were phenomena, unexplainable. But they, as Dave mentioned, they needed to happen. And that's exactly what this program of recovery is all about. It talks and uses in the big book terms, a man that knew a spiritual experience approached another man that knew a spiritual experience. And it's saying all through the book, you must have an experience. You can't have mine.
I mean, perhaps, it just occurred to me after vital, it means not just any spiritual experience do. There is a specific sort here which is going to keep you sober, and that's the one that comes as a result of the steps. I mean, maybe, perhaps that was the gist of it.
The word vital has different meanings, especially when you translate it. It can be very vivid, it can be necessary, it can be demand, it can be, so what is actually, in this case, the interpretation of vital?
Specifically necessary is the way, necessary.
Yes.
Necessary.
Yes. It's necessary.
Thank you.
Yes.
Livsnødvendig på dansk, for at vide det. livsnødvendigt. I don't have any more questions in writing. It's 9 o'clock, and I don't know if anybody is jumping. I want to ask something. Oh.
Hello. I have a question for both gentlemen. I'm Elisa, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. I just want to know, I have a few days in the program, and I just want to know what you two gentlemen do with your, with not the newcomers, but when you sponsor men, and they have got sobriety, how do you work with your sponsee, according to our vital traditions we have? Do you consider it is important also to work with new people on the road toward sobriety according to our tradition, and how do you do it if you do it and not? I mean,
I haven't had the experience of taking people through the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. There are some that have. I guess I've just been busy just with drunks, okay? But I know of people on Staten Island. I've only been busy with the drunks and working through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, taking through the steps, okay? You're talking about the traditions. Am I correct? Yes, yes. So what you're talking about is the traditions, okay, and helping alcoholics understand the traditions. There are 36 principles involved. And we have the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts. Okay. So when we have the 12 traditions, I know of people on Staten Island who will take the book Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, okay, and work people through the traditions through that. And I haven't had an experience myself with that, for the reasons previously mentioned. Working with the drunks, I guess. I just, you know, drunks come into my life faster than traditions do, I guess. I don't know. Oh, how do I continue to sponsor them? It's very important. And that's important what you're doing in terms of knowing our history and where we come from and why we come from there. And I agree with that wholeheartedly.
I'll just say that once, I'll go through the way that I was sponsored. I went through the first 9 steps. I did most of my amends within 6 months. And then there were others that I couldn't do at that stage, but I did gradually. But basically, I did most of them in the first 6 months. After that, it was 10, 11, 12. And my first sponsor died when I was 9 years sober. And I've had other sponsors since. So from that point on, the first thing he asked me to do was then just to read AA Comes of Age, so that I would start to read about the traditions and the history of AA. He encouraged me to go to, in London, we have step and tradition meetings. So they discuss a step a week, and then once a month you discuss a tradition. And I was told I had to go to one of those meetings as a regular. And if I didn't want to go to an existing one, start one. We also now actually have a 12 concepts discussion meeting every 2 months. Largely, concepts largely neglected. But, you know, we study those together as much as, you know, it's not really somebody passing on experience, a group of us really thinking about it and studying it. With regard to what the bulk of the conversations were once we've been through those first 9 steps, so I would get sort of questions and answers, but a lot of that time, he would be referring me to people who had specific experience in specific areas of service, you know, where, whatever I was dealing with. He certainly encouraged me to get involved in other levels of service. So, I did a lot of group service of the nature he described, but then I was encouraged to get up into intergroup and what would be the equivalent of America area, and I've been a conference delegate, I've been the chairman of my equivalent of area, London region. So I was pushed, I had no choice, you know, I had to start volunteering for those things. So that is how I maintain my development. He would sort of keep tabs on that. But the bulk of the sort of conversation that we would have when we kept in touch on a weekly basis was actually, I would be asking him questions about my sponsees. I've got a sponsee who's doing this. Have you come across this before? So he was helping me to sponsor. And that was what the gist of it was. Now, we talked weekly for the rest of the 9 years, and we would sort of catch up, and he'd know roughly what was going on. But frankly, if I phoned up and said, I'm having real difficulty with this situation, he would just say, well, have you done a step 10 inventory? And if I said no, the phone would be down. You know, he expected me to deal with most of these things. I mean, occasionally there were new situations which I couldn't deal with, and I needed help, and he would talk to me. But if I wasn't dealing with these things on my own, for the most part, by now, he'd want to know why. Because he just wouldn't talk to me unless I'd written it down and had a look at it. And usually when I did that, of course, there was nothing really to discuss. You know, I could see that it was my pride or my self-pity or something like that. But nevertheless, we would sort of chat about what I was doing. And it was very useful to talk to him if there was an unexpected situation or a serious one that I couldn't deal with. Occasionally I would do things of which, even in sobriety, I was deeply ashamed. You know, it's progress, not perfection. And I would, I never drank, but in terms of my morality, you know, I'd fall short of my ideals in areas of my life. And many areas I didn't need to tell him. But if it was something I was embarrassed about or deeply ashamed of, I would tell him those sort of things, as part of the sort of inventory taking process. And then also, he was just good as an objective viewpoint if I was making major decisions. And that's as much a role as a friend as a sponsor, if you see what I mean. But I trusted his advice. I knew he would tell me the truth if I was making a silly decision over something. So I would talk to him about that. But most of the greatest volume of conversation was him helping me to, in turn, sponsor others. Is that what you're looking for? Yeah.
I just got whispered a question. I'm over here, guys.
Oh, wow.
What do you do when you come to a meeting and most of the people are complaining and bitching about their work day or whatever happens, you know, the dryer or something like that, the washing machine breaking down? What do you do?
In the United States, we call that the firing line. And I just share my experience, my strength, and my hope. And I'm not really too concerned about what, if these people are talking about drama of life, as it says in the book. If I'm not hearing something in a meeting about how to have a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, and if I'm here in the middle of the road, that's fine. You know, I can hear the middle of the road, okay, but I don't know who's at that meeting. I don't know if the man is at that meeting that has been seriously considering maybe, you know, taking a gun to his head. No, it's, I must, you know, that he's suffering from untreated alcoholism. And this thing of just going to those type of meetings aren't working for him, and he knows it, and he's not getting an answer. I don't know if that man is going to be there or not. So I just keep on sharing my experience, my strength and hope, and the solution. not getting involved in all of that drama. But it's important for me to be in a fellowship where I'm around people on this path. Okay? Because I have to nourish my spirit from people on this path in our fellowship.
Yeah, I agree with absolutely everything. What I would say is there is a danger for me. My sponsor told me, he said, never let the disease win. There may be a newcomer in that meeting, just as you said, who doesn't know what's on offer in this program. It is important that they get to hear the good news. Now, if I'm the only person they're going to hear from, and I must say I do take a deep breath and just go for it, because I know that some people aren't going to like it. But what I try and do is adopt the attitude. I try and present it in a way that is not going to cause people to dig their heels in and resist. I mean, it's inevitable that is going to happen with some people. I try and adopt the attitude, the frame of mind, that everybody wants to be happy, and they're just doing the best they can to be happy. Many of those people who are complaining about those things, it's not as if they're light complaining. They genuinely are troubled by these things. It's very clear to me very often, with my experience and to you, that they don't need to be, but they are genuinely troubled by that. So I try and use phrases that assume that they would like to do this if only they knew about it. You see what I mean? So, for example, I might say, I have never found it helpful to share my problems in a meeting. I've always found that the most helpful thing is to talk to my sponsor about it and to share gratitude in the meeting. And that's what the big book tells me. And I explain the reasons. So, and say that if you work on the premise that you get what you give away, if I'm sharing misery in a meeting, all I'm doing is multiplying my misery. Now, the danger always in doing this is that I appear to be bellicose. You know, I look like I'm sort of taunting them. You know, I'm great, I'm doing the program, you're not, you're stupid. And it is inevitable that some people will take it that way. I mean, I just have to accept that fact. And they're the ones who, you know, some people are ready to hear that in what I say, and there's nothing I can do about it. But I just have to discount those people and aim for those who are genuinely unhappy, don't know the good news, and want to hear it. Just think, how can I say this in such a way, from my own experience, that they're going to want to reach out and grab it, and then just do my best. I mean, well, how successful I am, I have no idea.
My name is Ulla, I'm an alcoholic. So if your sponsee is not willing to go to any length, how do you define it, and how do you say thank you and goodbye?
Just as you've said it. It's it really is a case of saying I only want to sponsor those who want to hear what I have to say, and I just don't get into any arguments or discussion and say, well, you might be right, but, you know, why don't you go and find somebody who you are prepared to trust? You know, I had to trust my sponsor, and I wanted to hear what he had to say. You may be right. Perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps what I'm saying is not right for you. But if it isn't, then I'm not the sponsor for you. And I never argue with sponsees, because that's the end of the relationship, just as it was with my sponsor. On the critical principles and steps, I mean, we might argue about whether Liverpool is better than Arsenal or something, but on those, you know, there are certain things that are, from my experience, that's my experience, I can't change. They won't do it. You know, it was quite happily part company.
I can't recall being in a position where I have to fire, if you want to use that word, a sponsee. I wouldn't do that. But it's usually the situation where a sponsee is given a particular assignment to do out of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And if they're not doing it, they're not giving me a call back, and they're not showing up at my door. So they're gone before I even get an opportunity to say thank you. They're just not willing to go to any length. And I can understand that. It's just a situation where they haven't hit that place. Apparently, they must think somewhere along the line that something is working, still working for them. They have some reservations. I would probably call them, most likely, first-step reservations. They can do something else. I couldn't. I was done. I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't even know the man that was carrying the message to me. I didn't know this man that was carrying the message to me on a personal basis. But as it was said once before, you know, and I can identify with it, you know, I didn't know what he had, but I know what I had, okay? And I didn't want what I had anymore. And I was willing to go to any lengths to get rid of what I had.
Hi, my name's Helena, and I'm an alcoholic. I was thinking about, I'm very confused about this being a hard drinker or an alcoholic, and high bottom and denial and all this. How do you help newcomers with this problem, if there's any doubt? Also because I think the fellowship in Denmark is expanding, and more high bottom people
I work with people out of the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And as we shared during the course, the way it was shared with me and the way I found out my truth, okay, because if, I don't know if you were here when I was Sharon, I used to raise my hand in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings years before I was exposed to the Big Book, and I used to raise my hand and say, my name is Tom, I'm an addict, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, I'm a compulsive gambler. I went through that process in the Big Book, and I found out for me, I'm not an addict, I'm not even a compulsive gambler. But I'm a real alcoholic. And what that means is when I ingest alcohol, something happens. That doesn't happen to the normal temperate drinker. Okay? It's then this thing called the phenomenon of craving. And my body says more. Says more. I can't recall experience that my body never said more if I just look at the facts. Okay? And when I'm separated from alcohol, this obsession, this idea that outweighs all other ideas, even when I don't want a drink, it'll take me back to a drink. So I suffer from a physical and a mental obsession. Okay? That didn't happen with drugs with me. I walked away from drugs. But I found that out, that I'm not an addict by going through this process. I also found out that I'm not a compulsive gambler. Joke around about it today, but I have to grab my wife from the slot machines down in Atlantic City today to say, let's go get a bite to eat and see a show, you know. But no, I'm not that. But I am a real alcoholic. And how it was shared with me is the way that I share it with the alcoholic. It's interesting that we have from the doctor's opinion to about page 50 in the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that's only focused on the problem to find out if you're a real alcoholic. They lay a lot of emphasis on step one to really find out. Because if you're going to start a spiritual journey, okay, it's not a good idea to do it on a lie.
I think I represent a high bottom case. I had lots of doubts about whether or not I was an alcoholic when I came. And what I found is that the criteria, the key criteria that are described in the Big Book that have just been articulated, apply as much to me as they do to any low rock bottom case. You know, the mental obsession, I spoke about it when I spoke. As regards to helping me to see that, I mean, one is just reading that passage of the big book. The other thing that was suggested to me was that I speak to other people. You know, when I share my experience, I don't try and pretend that I went to prison and I did. You know, I don't try and exaggerate it. I try and say it exactly as it is so that people relate to it. And people will hear other people like themselves. But one thing that my sponsor told me to do, once I had a higher power, he suggested that I pray every day for the honesty of my condition. And I did that. And I have in turn suggested that to sponsors of mine. And nobody that I've come across has not had an answer to that question. In my case, what happened? So in other words, what we're asking for is not please tell me I am an alcoholic, please let me know whether or not I am. And prayers are answered. You know, God answers prayer. And the way that it worked for me was that one of the sort of daily suggestions for the daily routine at the beginning, just to sort of bed me into the fellowship, that I was given, was to try and talk to people who were newer than me. I was 3 weeks in at this stage. I used to get phone numbers of people, and I thought, what am I going to say? You know, and my sponsor said, just share your experience. He says, you're the world's number one expert on your experience. Don't give him opinions because nobody's interested in those. Just share your experience. So I did just that. And I didn't dress it up. And I was talking to this new guy. I don't know what his drinking level was, but what staggered me was that he was standing there saying, yes, that happened to me too. That happened to me too. I think I was just describing how I felt. You know, and that's the mechanism whereby it suddenly dawned on me I was in the right place. And to be honest, I was overjoyed. I thought, well, if this is all my problem is, at least there's an answer. You know, I thought I might be on a trail of psychotherapists for the rest of my life. But I believe that what allowed me to get that realization was the suggestion my sponsor gave me. He said, pray on as part of your prayers on your knees, ask for the honesty of your condition. That's what.
We will take the last question and then we'll wrap this thing up, and your mic is getting slow too. There seems to be a tendency in Denmark to sit in AA and wait for the newcomer who is sent to us from the treatment centers. Is it so in your groups also, or do you walk the streets for bringing out the message, and how? Got it?
Well, as a group, one of the obligations of the fifth tradition of the home of the of every group is to carry the message to the suffering alcoholic, and part of that, I mean, most of its activity, therefore, is carrying the message in terms of what its individuals share in the meeting. You know, the period before and after the meeting, the conduct, sort of, if you like, during the, while they hire the hall for the meeting time. But part of a group's activities, in accordance with this tradition, and also for every individual, in accordance with this tradition, are to participate in AA carrying the message outside the group. Now, for most groups, that means participating in the service structure, so that you're doing it in cooperation with the other groups around. So we have intergroup. I don't know how the words are in the, sort of, in the Danish service structure. But if your group is not participating in the service structure, then according to this tradition, you ought to be. Now, how this means that you get more people coming to your group, well, God moves in mysterious ways. But if you're putting in the footwork, the people will come somehow. Very often it's not... It's like all these things, not directly through your efforts, but if the group is doing the right things, the people will come. I do know of some groups who are in isolated positions, and so they didn't really need to cooperate with other groups. So they actually went to hospital wards and said, would you like to come to an AA meeting? And do all those things that you see old-timers doing in the literature. But it's quite possible, certainly in London, to do it indirectly. You send your service representative to the intergroup, and you participate in service committees, and even if you're making the tea at the intergroup meeting, indirectly you're contributing to this work outside, working through the telephone office, all this stuff. If you're doing work outside the group, you're helping to bring newcomers to the group from all directions. Now, the mechanisms by which it's happened, the most common way, it's funny actually, there's a huge debate at the moment in Britain. The fellowship is shrinking, and the reason is, in my opinion, that as the service structure doesn't conform to the concepts and traditions, whatever, however that manifests itself, that is the difficulty. And there are all these discussions about renewed PI activities. How can we get more people in? They're about to have a big billboard advertising campaign in London for AA. Now, this might work, but the experience, it was read out in the yesterday. The most common reason for people coming to AA is because they see somebody personally who has recovered. And so, as individuals, just going about, I let people know when it's the right time. I don't just flaunt it, but that I'm just, I used to have a drinking problem, now I don't because I'm in AA. Once they know me, and once, you know, I don't want to put people on the spot or make them embarrass them or anything. But at the right time, I do my best to let people know. And it is personal contact with a recovering alcoholic that is going to bring people in. And then after that, I'll just vent my spleen here. I believe that the reason that the fellowship in Britain is shrinking, actually, it's a leaking bucket. And people are coming in at the top, and the water's going out at the bottom. And if we have a huge, successful advertising campaign, we may get more people coming in. But if the bucket's leaking, the faster you pour the water in, the faster it goes out the bottom. The problem, actually, is not people coming into AA, whether it's from treatment centres or from personal contact. The problem is that they don't stay when they get here. And that's the steps. So we need to participate in all that stuff. But ultimately, the biggest task is to deal with the people who actually do make it here. That is why Britain isn't great. I don't know what the situation is in Denmark. We have newcomers. It's not worry about where they come from or what their profile is. It's that they're not getting the message when they get here.
Thank you. My experience with actually going out, we have a home group. We have responsibilities in that home group by each individual. We have GSR. There's intergroup representatives, institutions representative. What we mean by that, and we don't have all that criteria, you know, like filled, all those positions, the primary to keep the group going is there. As Dave mentioned, our home group is just happened to be based on the text Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book. And our group conscience is to have speakers come in to share their experience, their strength, and their hope, provided, and it's our group conscience that these people have gone through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, begun making amends, as it's outlined in the book, and are living in 10, 11, and 12. Now, when we started around a little over 6 years ago, there were only maybe about 5 to 10, and that would shrink back and forth. Today, we usually have no less than 50 to 60 people at each meeting. You share the truth, the groups grow, and people stay. My experience, I think I may have shared it earlier, you know, like a couple of years ago I went into Brooklyn and there were 100 people maybe at that meeting, and I remember being at the same meeting 20 years prior, and I could tell you at the meeting a couple of years ago, I may remember less than a handful of people at that meeting. Dave hit it right on the head. It's not that we have to grow. No one is staying. I don't know where these people are. could be dead, could just stop going to Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe they figured they don't need it. I don't know. But I just know the few groups that we have in our area that are working with the book and doing it as outlined in this book, it's we're having the opposite effect. We're growing.
Thank you.